Thank you, Andra and Susie. One of my very favorite readings on the subject of gratitude is from this little slim volume from Dr. Albert Schweitzer. It's titled Memoirs of Childhood and Youth. And the origin of this little volume, I think, is worth mentioning. In May of 1923, almost 100 years ago now, Albert Schweitzer, who was then in his late 40s, was crisscrossing Switzerland in a series of speaking engagements. And one day he had a two-hour layover in Zurich. And so he decided to visit a friend, a well-known Zurich psychoanalyst by the name of Dr. Oscar Pfister. Dr. Pfister had Schweitzer stretch out on a couch to rest his weary body. But at the same time, he made him narrate, just as they came into his mind, events and memories from his childhood and youth. Pfister wanted to use these stories for an article for a young people's magazine he was preparing for. Well, shortly thereafter, Dr. Pfister sent Schweitzer a copy of what he had taken down in shorthand during those 2 hours. Schweitzer wrote back asking him not to complete the article, but instead one afternoon wrote down as an epilogue some of the thoughts that stirred in him as he remembered the persons and events from his youth. The result is one of the small classics about childhood, and I'm going to read a portion of that memoir, and you'll be able to follow the words on the screen. Dr. Schweitzer writes, "When I look back upon my early days, I am stirred by the thought of the number of people whom I have to thank for what they gave me or for what they were to me. At the same time, I am haunted by an oppressive consciousness of the little gratitude I really showed them while I was young. How many of them have said farewell to life without my having made clear to them what it meant to me to receive from them so much kindness or so much care? Many a time have I, with a feeling of shame, said quietly to myself over a grave the words which my mouth ought to have spoken to the departed while he or she was still in the flesh. For all that, I think I can say with truth that I am not ungrateful. I did occasionally wake up out of that youthful thoughtlessness, which accepted as a matter of course all the care and kindness that I experienced from others. And I believe I became sensitive to my duty in this matter just as early as I did to the prevalence of suffering in the world. But down to my 20th year, and even later still, I did not exert myself sufficiently to express the gratitude which was really in my heart. I valued too low the pleasure felt at receiving real proofs of gratitude. Often too, shyness prevented me from expressing the gratitude that I really felt. As a result of this experience with myself, I refuse to think that there is as much ingratitude in the world as is commonly maintained. I have never interpreted the parable of the healing of the 10 lepers by Jesus to mean that only one was grateful. All the 10 surely were grateful, but 9 of them hurried home first so as to greet friends and attend to their business as soon as possible, intending to go to Jesus soon afterwards and thank him. But things turned out otherwise. They were kept at home longer than they meant to be, and in the meanwhile, Jesus was put to death. One of them, however, had a disposition which made him act at once as his feelings bade him. He sought out the person who had helped him and refreshed his soul with the assurance of his gratitude. In the same way, we ought all to make an effort to act on our first thoughts and let our unspoken gratitude find expression. Then there will be more sunshine in the world and more power to work for what is good. But as concerns ourselves, we must all of us take care not to adopt as part of our theory of life people's bitter sayings about the ingratitude in the world. A great deal of water is flowing underground, which never comes up as a spring. In that thought, we might find comfort, but we ourselves must try to be the water which does find its way up. We must become a spring at which men and women can quench their thirst for gratitude." It's hard to imagine what the life of the spirit would be like if it did not include a generous portion of gratitude. The quality of gratitude is certainly a fundamental quality of a life that would have any spiritual substance at all. I look upon gratitude not, first of all, as a cheery thing or a bubbly thing. Gratitude, as I view it, is not about trying to look on the bright side of things. It's not an attempt to avoid the bass notes in life or the minor keys. It's not an attempt to deny or overlook the pain, sorrow, and horror of life. Nor, again, does gratitude have to do with positive thinking, with trying to buck yourself up or gear yourself up. Gratitude is, however, a posture in which one becomes awake to what is rather than to what is not. In gratitude, one says a mighty yes to life as it is, not as it might be, could be, should be, or is yet to be, but as it is. Now, often we become aware of what is when we realize what might not be. Our gratitude is stirred when we realize that this world with all its treasures doesn't have to be, that this country in which we live, its values and ideals, as we are so recently becoming aware, these values and ideals don't have to be. This state of Washington and this gorgeous local region of mountains, forests, and seas in which most of us live, this doesn't have to be. The flowers that bloom in their abundance in the spring and the summer don't have to be. The deciduous trees that have by now dropped most of their autumn leaves don't have to be. And you and I engaged in this communication this morning virtually don't have to be. When we meditate on what doesn't have to be, we realize we can't take it for granted. And then perhaps we become a little bit more awake to what is here and to what we have. And as we awaken in this way, gratitude seems spontaneously to arise from us. I can imagine a type of meditation for cultivating and enhancing our gratitude in which, for a couple of minutes each day, we were to walk through our world, and with respect to any given thing that we would come upon, we would say, "This doesn't have to be." Whatever its flaws, however we might like to change and adjust a given thing, the awareness that something has being rather than non-being is a startling recognition that arouses our gratitude. When windswept fires such as the recent ones in California, or when devastating tornadoes or hurricanes strike, or even when we encounter flooding as such as this past week in our area, individuals literally have to go through a meditation of what doesn't have to be. Such events bring to my mind a time over 40 years ago when my wife Flossie and I lived on the island of Guam in the South Pacific. At that time, I was the director of a student and serviceman center in Guam, and just before my two-year appointment was over, this was from 1976, way back there. Just before I was to finish that, a horrific typhoon swept through our island. The typhoon in that part of the world is called a hurricane. In this part of the world, and I think cyclone now is the more common current word for both hurricanes and cyclones. But at any rate, this particular typhoon was named Typhoon Pamela. Sustained winds of 135 miles an hour, gusting to 165 miles an hour. Almost every wooden structure on the island went down. Most any building not made of concrete with reinforced steel rods went down. And those concrete buildings in which cheating had occurred with respect to the building codes, they went down. Inside this storm, which lasted for about 2 days, I went through a kind of meditation of what doesn't have to be. It's a meditation that goes something like this. As you learn from the news media that a huge storm is heading your way, you begin to make preparations, boarding up buildings, taping up windows, trying to preserve your various material possessions. And as the storm continues to head in your direction, you hope against hope that perhaps it will yet turn from its course, miss your island, and head out to sea. When the storm doesn't turn and the winds begin to really blow, you take shelter with others inside the strongest building you can find, and you wait and you listen as the storm revs up, hoping that not too much gets destroyed. As the intensity of the storm increases and the wind whistles, and it's the noise of these storms that gets to you, the howling of the wind, the ripping tin, grinding metal, cracking tree limbs. As the intensity of the storm increases, you begin hearing small objects moving about. And in your mind, you begin to let go of certain material possessions. Crack, there goes our palm tree. Crash, was that our car that just got hit? And then, when the storm hits you with its full fury and the building begins to shake and rumble, and as the water is being driven sideways through concrete walls and you hear larger objects flying about, it is then that the fear grips you. And you're willing then, very willing, to let go of material things. All material things. You'll gladly sacrifice any and every material possession you own just to spare your life and that of your loved ones. Then, quite suddenly, the storm subsides. But it's not over. Actually, it's only half over. In this case, the eye of Typhoon Pamela went directly over the island. And so there's a pause in the action for a period of an hour or so. You come out of your shelter, just a faint breeze, very quiet, blue sky, and multitudes of birds soaring and floating in the eye of the typhoon. Apparently, they're riding out the storm by staying in its center. Being in the eye of the storm means the winds of this huge circular natural event will now reverse themselves. And so, after a brief respite, back into the shelter you go, and you replay the same process, but from the other direction. And when 12 to 15 hours later, the storm finally ends, and you find that you have your life and that of your loved ones, you go outside to survey the damage, profoundly grateful to be alive, not initially worrying about what you've lost in terms of material possessions. And actually then, when you find certain material things that did survive, you're also grateful for them. You're not angry or bitter about what has been destroyed. You're grateful for what you have, grateful for what hasn't been destroyed. These things don't have to be. And so the storm has led you in a meditation of what doesn't have to be. Later, as the days and weeks and months pass, this sense of gratitude will diminish and you may return again to normal and find yourself becoming irritated again over little losses and inconveniences that during and immediately after the storm you would have regarded as extremely minor. And yet, perhaps a memory, a residue of feeling lingers. Perhaps the meditation has taught you something about the quality and spirit an origin of gratitude. Another example of a type of meditation on what doesn't have to be that is familiar to many is the experience of a loved one not coming home at the appointed time. You're expecting your loved one at a certain time, but that time passes and passes and stretches out beyond your normal allowances for being late. You begin to worry. Did something happen to him or her? Did he or she get into an accident? As the time stretches out and stretches out, you start planning the memorial service. You start wondering what your life will be like without your loved one. Then finally, you hear the car in the driveway. You rush out to see if everything is all right, and you find the person is alive and safe, and everything is all right, just a delay of some sort, and and you are so happy and so relieved and so grateful, you give your loved one a great big hug. The possibility of loss, of what might not be, brings out your gratitude, and you realize what the person means to you, and you're grateful. You're so very, very grateful. Of course, shortly thereafter, you might also begin to realize that this person could have called. As a matter of fact, this person should have called. And now you begin to get angry and upset, and your gratitude, so very present just moments ago, quite suddenly dissipates and is taken over by some other focus of attention. But again, at least for a time, your gratitude was awakened by the awareness of what might not be. Of course, it's not just the threat of loss that awakens our gratitude, but actual loss. As a minister of 44 plus years, I have officiated at many memorial services, hundreds of them actually, and I discovered a long time ago that it's often at the time of death that we realize more fully than we ever have before just what we've had and what we no longer will have. And often we experience deep gratitude for what we've had, as well as some regret that we could not have experienced and expressed this gratitude more completely while the person was alive, very much as that reading from Albert Schweitzer that we read earlier said. But perhaps it's not really possible to completely and adequately feel and express this gratitude while living. I actually don't think it is possible. I think that it's only in the actual experience of loss that we learn the most profound gratitude. We wish that it weren't so. We wish we could fully experience and express our gratitude in the present. But to me, this is just one of the many ironies and paradoxes of life. Namely, you can't truly measure what you have until you no longer have it. This too is part of accepting life as it is. Other situations that arouse our gratitude are those in which we are taught what we have through comparison with others. For example, we may be feeling sorry for ourselves, complaining in some way about some lack we perceived, something not quite as we wanted, irritated by situations that we think could be better. And then we meet a person who has a much greater reason to complain or much greater limitations than our own. But this person is not complaining at all. This person is actually full of a generous and grateful spirit. The comparison stops us in our tracks, shames us, wakes us up, and returns us to a more appropriate posture toward our life and our world. Yet other situations and circumstances in which our gratitude is awakened have to do in times when we are released from illness, pain, or limitation. When we are sick, all the things we took for granted are no longer granted us, and we begin to reflect on and appreciate what we've had. And then, as our health returns, little things that we don't normally notice or appreciate are suddenly noticed and appreciated. I recall, for example, visiting a person some time ago who had to be flat on her back for a period of several weeks. She was so grateful then when she could later go to the bathroom by herself, and later still when she made it into her kitchen. How beautiful her kitchen looked. My wife, Flossie, and I have gone through this kind of experience in the last several months, as we learned on March 1st of this year that Flossie had advanced ovarian cancer. At first, we didn't know. We didn't know. Weeks left, months left. It was a tender time, and we didn't know. A couple of weeks after we found out about the existence of the ovarian cancer, we responded with joy when the surgeon said, now, when we have surgery, we can have surgery. A few days ago, from this past week, after months of recovering from that surgery, including multiple chemo infusions, Flossie, astro-oncologist, am I officially in remission now? The oncologist looked at her and smiled, you most certainly are. Obviously, a time of gratitude for both of us. Yet again, another occasion in which our gratitude is awakened, and similar to ones just mentioned, is when we are released from pain. In pain, it's very hard to feel grateful. We may have a posture of gratitude toward the world, but in pain, in real and severe pain, we simply can't feel that gratitude. The pain wipes out any feelings of gratitude. But when the pain lets up and we are released from the sentence, then once again, we feel our gratitude for what we have. Persons, as they get older, often tend to have a greater sense of gratitude. When we are younger and just beginning to engage the world, we don't know yet how tenuous things are, how easily things break, how quickly things change, how without announcement things fly away. When we're younger, we tend to think that what we see is permanent, that this is the way things are, and we take that then as our base. We focus on the future from that base, looking for ways to develop and improve from that base. However, as we grow older, we see more disappear, and we see ourselves disappearing as well. We discover that much is quite fragile. Just a slip here, a loss of footing there, a fall, an accident, something unintended, being in the wrong place. We realize what doesn't have to be. And out of this experience, there often develops a greater sense of gratitude. And so it seems to me that the root of gratitude, or at least the occasion of gratitude, is the philosophical and religious understanding that all we have does not have to be. Anything and everything we have, if properly understood, is to be received as a gift. A member of a congregation I once served, a woman named Anne Wendlandt, once summarized this approach in a lovely rhyming couplet. It was in the slide at the beginning of the service, these words, everything we have, we borrow, all our joy and all our sorrow. Everything we have, we borrow, all our joy and all our sorrow. Thus, nothing is a right. Nothing is to be taken for granted. Nothing is owed us. All has come to us unbidden. We did not create it. Our appearance on this planet is not something that should be noted. Rather, we are the ones who should take note of what is here. You may be familiar with the statement of the biblical figure of Job, who, after everything that he owned and loved was destroyed, said, naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I shall return. Yahweh gave, Yahweh has taken back. Blessed be the name of Yahweh, Yahweh being the name of Job's creator, God. And here's a modern poem by the poet, novelist, essayist, environmentalist, farmer, Wendell Berry, a poem that gets at the same theme, a poem that may help us to prepare the soil from which the quality of gratitude may spring. It's a poem in which the poet reviews the year gone by, and you can follow the words of this poem on the screen. George, if you could bring that up, please. By expenditure of hope, intelligence, and work, you think you have it fixed. It is unfixed by rule. Within the darkness, all is being changed, and you also will be changed. Now I recall to mind a costly year. Jane Kenyon, Bill Lippert, Philip Sherrard, all in the same spring, dead. So much companionship gone as the river goes. And my good workhorse, Nick, dead, who called out to me in his convulsive pain to ask my help. I had no help to give. And flood covered the cropland twice. By summer's end, there are no more perfect leaves. But won't you be ashamed to count the passing year at its mere cost, your debt inevitably being paid? For every year is costly, as you well know. Nothing is given that is not taken, and nothing taken that was not first a gift. The gift is balanced by its total loss. And yet the light breaks in, heaven seizing its moments that are at once its own and yours. The day ends and is unending, where the summer tanager, warbler, and vireo sing as they move among illuminated leaves. Nothing is given that is not taken, and nothing taken that was not first a gift. The sense of gratitude, it seems to me, depends on coming to this perspective, the deep knowledge that nothing we are or have can be demanded or expected or is ours by right. Everything we have, everything we are, is to be received as a gift. No entitlement, no guarantees, no ownership, nothing ours by right of birth, nothing ours by right of effort. Nothing belongs to us, nothing ever did, nothing ever will. And in the moment that we start to believe that something does belong to us for whatever reason, I think we're in spiritual trouble. The key to gratitude, the key to making our way through the world, is the discovery that anything we have ever had or ever will have is a gift and nothing but a gift. This is a key that will have to be learned, that we will need to learn over and over and over and over and over again. And when we see on those days and in those times when we do see that nothing belongs to us, that nothing had to be, ourselves included, then all of life becomes a gift, a miracle, to which our gratitude is our natural and spontaneous response. Or, as the poet Gary Snyder has written, after the mind-breaking void, the emptiness of a million universes appearing and disappearing, all created things rushing into Krishna's devouring mouth, beyond the enlightenment that can say, these things are dead already, go ahead and kill them, Arjuna, is a loving, simple awareness of the absolute beauty and preciousness of mice and weeds. Our closing words are those of the Reverend Richard Fuchs, and this will be followed by a short traditional Thanksgiving Day song, then the extinguishing of our chalice by Susie Wilson, and finally concluding our service today with the circle song led by Kathy Roche Zuko. This from the Reverend Richard Fuchs. For the sun and the dawn, which we did not create, for the moon and the evening, which we did not make, for food which we plant but cannot grow, for friends and loved ones we have not earned and cannot buy, for all things which come to us as gifts of being from sources beyond ourselves, gifts of life and love and friendship, we lift up our hearts in thanks this day.